is Susan Kalman, and I have a lot of convictions. Not like that, don't worry, I'm too lazy to run away from the police. I mean that I have very strong beliefs, and I want to tell you how I got them. In this show, I'm going to tell you why I didn't think my cultural identity was important, but then realised that my Scottish roots were what defined me. First of all, and I want to say this up front, this is not a show about Scottish nationalism. I firmly believe that it is possible to discuss the concept of nationality in isolation from nationalism. It's exactly the same as making meringue and realising you don't necessarily need to make pavlova. You might like horses, but it doesn't mean you believe in unicorns. Besides, I get very upset when I think about people splitting up like the SDP or the Spice Girls. For the listeners at home, you should know I'm recording this show at the wonderful Traverse Theatre in Edinburgh. The nation's capital. If you don't know, we have our own parliament in Edinburgh, a place called Holyrood, which, for information, is just north of Brigadoon. If you haven't been there and want to paint a mental picture for yourself, then think of the glamour of Hollywood, and then think of the exact opposite. With kilts. I'm not from here myself. Instead, I hail from Glasgow, which, unlike Edinburgh, doesn't have a castle. But it does have an amazing bus station and a new motorway junction. Recording this show in Scotland is very exciting for me, as it means I can say words like bism and stramash and coup without facing a puzzled audience. I may drop some Scottish phrases into the show just for fun and sit back and wait for the inevitable letters of complaint. Dear BBC, I was shocked to turn on my wireless, only to hear a woman with an accent that sounded like two sparrows punching each other whilst trapped in the lid of a grand piano. In addition, the constant use of the noise made it sound like someone was spitting. I'm all for hearing from the regions, but surely they could simply write a letter. Yours in disgust, Jonathan Smythington Smythe. I jest, of course. The listeners will be used to a certain smattering of Scottish accents in popular culture. A prime example of that is the fabulous Sean Connery, the world's least convincing foreigner. I understand his pain, though. I'm notorious for being able to play any nationality, as long as they're Scottish. Australian, American, even regional dialects from inside the UK are not a problem for me, as long as they were originally from Scotland and they lived the majority of their life there. The problem is, I can never sound anything other than really, really Scottish. But it's taken me a long time to realise what my nationality actually means. Growing up, the visible representation of what it meant to be Scottish seemed to be few and far between. There was Isla St Clair on the Generation Game. She's a superb woman who favoured the long tartan skirt and spoke like she was a maiden from the Glen. Miss Jean Brodie, who moulded her girls into the creme de la creme. And, of course, the White Heather Club. A BBC Scotland variety show that bears as much of a resemblance to everyday life in Scotland as Allo Allo does to the reality of being in the French Resistance. When I was younger, it seemed as if the whole of the country was embroidered from heather and mist, apart from one incident, which was an exciting blip on that flowery horizon. The year was 1978 and Scotland had qualified for the World Cup in Argentina. England hadn't qualified for the tournament, and so the manager of the Scotland team, Ali McLeod, decided to talk up our chances. People even started whispering about winning the trophy, the World Cup. The reality is, of course, that Scotland had as much chance of winning as I have of winning the Nobel Peace Prize. But the excitement in Scotland at the time was palpable. The anthem for the squad, Ali's Tartan Army, is one of the best yet most embarrassing legacies from the one time when the Scots dared to believe Andy Cameron was on top of the pot. Perhaps predictably, the Scotland football team didn't progress beyond the first round. Some might say it was embarrassing. I don't agree. I think the truth is that the whole affair brought out the best in the Scots. Our enterprising nature, the fact that we might take an idea dismissed as folly by other nationalities and run with it. We're dreamers, we're inventors, we're entrepreneurs. Take the famous story of Jim Tate, who drew up plans to charter a submarine to take fans to Argentina for the World Cup. A submarine. The total cost for fuel and provisions was to be £40,000 for the trip, and apparently an experienced crew would be part of the deal. Which is reassuring. As I would have thought that one of the prerequisites for a submarine is a crew. There was to be room for up to 180 passengers, and the sub would sail from the Clyde direct to South America. I'm not sure why the plan didn't take off. Apart from the fact it was as close as you can get to the start of an episode of Casualty. I must tell you, Edinburgh, that to my shame, I have apologised on a number of occasions for being Scottish. For example, when someone hasn't been able to understand me on the phone, when I haven't been able to get to a meeting in central London without at least 24 hours notice and several hours on the train, and when I sing the Proclaimers very, very loudly whenever I've had more than one beer. Why have I apologised in the past? Well, mostly because being a Scot seemed to comprise a few stereotypical things. Things that were as much a part of my childhood as the handmade doll of a Spanish lady that my gran put over the spare toilet roll in the bathroom. I remember that doll to this day. What was meant to be a simple decorative touch was instead the stuff of nightmares. The Spanish lady's face had melted a little in the sun, and her one eye used to follow you wherever you went. Whenever I had to use the facilities when I visited my gran, I kept my eyes closed throughout. I learnt an important lesson on those visits. Always keep your eyes open when using the toilet. Or one day you'll open your eyes and realise you're in the dining room. So what are these Scottish traditions? Well, at school, most children learn the noble art of Scottish country dancing. Generally taught in a lesson called social dancing. Perhaps the biggest contradiction I've ever encountered. A smelly gym hall containing a group of prepubescent teens, powered only by their overactive hormones, having to touch one another to the sound of accordions. I think it does something to you when one's first encounter of what could be considered a sexual nature takes place whilst a middle-aged woman with a whistle round her neck shouts instructions at you. The fact is that Scottish country dancing is a more dangerous hobby than juggling chainsaws whilst being chased by a bear. Done well, a ceilidh is a gentle and dignified event. Badly executed, it becomes, in essence, a woman throwing competition. Yeah. set to music. But it's still there in my soul, ready to erupt at the drop of a Tam O'Shanter. Hogmanay is, of course, another of the great Scottish traditions. All over the world, people celebrate the new year with tartan and bagpipes. For one night of the year, the TV couldn't have been more Scottish if it screamed, "Och aye," whilst Molly Weir sang the Skyboat song. It bore no resemblance to the dim avocado-coloured living room that the Calman family celebrated New Year in. For a start, no one in my family played the accordion, or the pipes, or the fiddle. The closest we had was an uncle who could play "Yes, We Have No Bananas" on the spoons. Scottish country dancing and Hogmanay were the essence of Scotland. If you'd cut me in half, a Cayley tablet would have fallen out. For those not aware of what tablet is, it's a Scottish confectionery. What you do is melt some sugar in a pan, and then you add more sugar. And then you let it set. Then you add more sugar. And then you roll it in sugar. And when you eat it, you can actually hear your teeth screaming. But what else is Caledonian in the extreme? Well, national dress, of course, not the "see you, Jimmy" hat, the kilt. It's astonishing how the entire nation has become inextricably associated with what was originally traditional dress only in the Highlands. Now it's de rigueur for boys to be given parts of the kilt as they grow up because, like a D'Agostini magazine collection containing 5,000 component parts, which will eventually build a replica of the spruce goose, it contains several elements. The kilt itself, the sporran, the ski and do. Whether they like it or not, many young men are presented with a skirt and the relevant accessories for their 16th, 18th and 21st birthdays. This means that for the rest of that boy's life, he's forced to wear the kilt, lest his mother or other family member reminds him of how much that cost us. One of the crucial genetic strands that's essential for being a Scot is Robert Burns. Every year on the 25th of January, we celebrate Robert Burns Day, our national poet. Now, not many other countries do that. Imagine Australia dedicating a day to its greatest poet and lyricist. Minogue Day just doesn't sound right. Every year at school, I was forced to learn a Burns poem and recite it in a competition in front of the school. Think of the Olympics opening ceremony and then forget it. I never won. I mean, it's not easy when you're 8 to say the words "we sleek at Curran timorous beastie, oh what a panic's in thy breastie," without laughing. Sadly, Burns has become as commercialised as anything else in the modern world. Tins of shortbread with his face on it, T-shirts, ashtrays. One of my most treasured possessions is a bottle of Coca-Cola that was produced for his 250th anniversary. It has Robert Burns' face on it. What's more Scottish than an American soft drink? Apart from McDonald's. I was also brought up knowing that my southern cousins, and by that I mean the English, not people from Dumfries, were, how can I say this, despised by some. It's a curious one to me. When I was growing up, I do remember a few jokes, mainly about football, about the English. You may not know this, right, but England won the World Cup in 1966. But then Scotland beat England in 1967, so apparently we are better. It's a good argument, right? But I don't think it totally works. If I wait a couple of years, right, until Jessica Ennis is out of shape and injured and asleep and then beat her at running, it doesn't make me practically an Olympic champion. I do admit it would be nice if when I went to London I could use my money as I pleased. I usually try and sandwich a Scottish note between two English notes so they don't notice. But I, I personally don't hate the English, right? I think you're all smashing, genuinely. You know, if I found an English person in my house, I wouldn't hurt you. I'd just pop a wee glass over your head, a wee piece of paper underneath, and I'd just pop you outside. After my early years, I was fully immersed into the basics of Scottish culture. I sang Flower of Scotland, I ate tatty scones, I read The Bruins and Oor Willie. Just be careful when you're Googling that later on, OK? As I got older, I began to see some things, though, that made me uneasy about what I'd learned. In my teenage years, I became aware of Rabsy Nesbitt, who was a philosopher, albeit one that liked a drink or five. I watched the Austin Powers film and saw a horrendous caricature called Fat Bastard. A grossly obese, red-haired man who constantly stuffed his face. And as I started to travel outside of my home country, everywhere I went, I was made aware of the particular stereotypes of what being Scottish meant. We're tight with money. There is a long-held belief that we Scots have a tight hold on our wallets. That is not true. It's just that it's often so cold it hurts to open our wallets. And we are careful, which is why our banks are so successful. We're drunken louts now. I won't lie about this one. We do enjoy a drink, and that's fine. But that's not an exclusively Scottish trait, though. I think it's a hobby often enjoyed by those who aren't the most optimistic of peoples. And we're not, probably because the one time that we were was in 1978. At the World Cup. We swear a lot. But we swear with the composition and the delicacy of Beethoven or Mozart. The combination of the accent and the swearing can lead to some people believing that we are an aggressive race. Untrue. It's just the way we sound. We can even make a compliment sound quite threatening. For example, the compliment, "That's a pretty baby!" Our cooking is unhealthy and we all deep fry our food. Now, this myth is partly based on one fact, one hideous event that has scarred our reputation forever, the deep fried Mars bar. I've never had a deep fried Mars bar. I would never have a deep fried Mars bar. Although I have had a deep fried doner kebab pizza. It's something they call the heart attack special in my local chippy. It's delicious and exciting at the same time. It's like playing Russian roulette with your arteries. The one thing I do accept regarding our cuisine is that haggis is weird. I'll probably get drummed out of Scotland for this, but I don't get it. My name is Susan Kalman, and I don't like haggis, whiskey, Iron Brew or Kayleys. I've said it now. You can call me Assassinag later if you want. I've suffered professionally because of the stereotypes of the Scots. Do you know the most common part that I'm asked to audition for? Genuinely. Racist alcoholic. Nothing says trouble like a short Scottish lady in a tracksuit with a can of special brew in her hand. Of course, the reputation of the Scots has some advantages. This is an absolutely true story. My sister experienced one of the advantages firsthand when she was on a trip to South America. She decided she wanted to see penguins in their natural habitat. We share a love of penguins. Who doesn't? She decided to take a bus at 3 a.m. from Chile to Argentina. The bus stopped at the border and the passengers were required to present their documents to several heavily armed Argentinian soldiers. Amongst those travelling on the bus were two young Englishmen who were given a rather hard time by the guards. It's fair to say that several decades of history were spewed forth onto the unsuspecting tourists, the Falklands, Diego Maradona. You get the picture. My sister watched this with some trepidation, not only because she was a woman travelling on her own, but she's even shorter than me. At around 4'8", it's like she's the smallest section of a Russian doll. The soldiers called her forward. She presented her passport. They practically spat at her. Bah, English. I told you I was good at accents. She squeaked, "No, I'm Scottish." They stopped and they stared at her. And then the guards, as one, lowered their guns, shouted, "Freedom!" and waved her through the border without even searching her bag. It was when I was in my late teens that I started to really think about what it meant to me to be Scottish. And I started to investigate notable Scots that I might not have been taught about. Women like Flora Drummond, who, although from Manchester, moved to Glasgow in her teens and was instrumental in the suffragette marches that took place in Edinburgh in the early 1900s. Carrying a whip and dressed in a military uniform, she was nicknamed the General and led hundreds of women in a march through the city of Edinburgh to demand the right to vote. Like a much slower, much less bloody, and much more administratively focused version of Braveheart. In this woman, who was only about 5 foot tall, I found inspiration. If only I could dress in a military uniform and ride a horse through the streets of Edinburgh. That's a festival show right there. I'd need to find a horse first, though, and perhaps surprisingly, I don't know a lot of people who've got a horse. If push comes to shove, my neighbour has a large Alsatian called Polly, who could possibly pass as a pony to the untrained eye. I began to realise that I'd grown up in a country that produced not only great minds, but figures of extraordinary courage. Elsie Ingalls was a remarkable woman who in the 1880s set up her own medical school in Edinburgh. During the First World War, she set up hospitals and went to Serbia, where she worked to improve hygiene and reduce typhus and other epidemics. These were women and Scots to be proud of, to celebrate. This wasn't the violent, drunken image that I'd seen on television. Nor was it the twee, romantic version of the Scots. I became obsessed with the Scottish Enlightenment, a period in the 18th century which was an outpouring of intellectual and scientific accomplishments. By 1750, Scots were amongst the most literate citizens of Europe, with an estimated 75% level of literacy. The culture was oriented to books, and the figures involved in the time still resonate today. David Hume, Adam Smith, Burns, Joseph Black, James Hutton. And the ideas didn't just stay in Scotland. Across Europe and America, its ideas and attitudes influenced life far away from this small land. At one point, Scotland was the most outward-looking nation in the world. Inventors like John Logie Baird, Sir James Barry, Alexander Graham Bell, explorers like William Spears Bruce, James Bruce and David Livingstone, and Scotty from Star Trek. Whose catchphrase, "She can't take it much longer," I often shout at bickering couples in the street. And then I run away. I discovered a newfound pride in what Scotland was. But then something happened. A moment of more concern to me than the prospect of travelling in a submarine to Argentina. You might recall we had an appalling spell of bad weather last year. It was fierce winds battered the country, causing immense damage. I myself hid under the bed with the cats until it was safe to come out. I finally left my den after a few hours to find that on Twitter, the storm had been coined Hurricane Bobak. It was being used with glee by my fellow Scots, who were full of joy when a newsreader read out the term.
He said Bobak. I think Eddie Mayer said Bobak on the Today Show, he did.
All over the world, the term Hurricane ball bag was used with abandon.
You're going to hate this next bit.
As a nation, we invented the steam engine, the television, and the telephone. We discovered penicillin, radar, and insulin. And all I can think of is this what we have become? From the most literate country in the world, we end up delighted about using the term bawbag. This was the moment I made the decision. I decided that I needed to make a change. I needed to stop apologising for who I was and bring the Enlightenment back. I was like a superhero, but without a lair or a costume or any powers. So not really like a superhero. But I had a motto. WWTED, what would the Enlightenment do? We are, and always have been, outspoken as a nation. And one of the things the Enlightenment argued most strongly for was that people should think for themselves rather than simply believe what they are told. We should talk up our achievements, not ignore them. And if there's one thing that we are really good at in Scotland, it's talking. Not about anything emotional. We're not French. This can be a new period of Scottish enlightenment, of pride in who we are. I took to standing outside tourist shops which sell the usual tartan tat, holding a sign that said, Macbeth was actually quite a nice man. I am Elsie Ingalls, I shouted. I am David Hume and Robert Burns and Jim Tate. Being Scottish is much more than we let people see, and we need to let them see it. And I'll ride my Alsatian through the streets of Edinburgh, dressed as a general until that day comes. It's been an odd journey, and many of you won't agree with my conclusion, but I'm absolutely convinced that I'm proud to be Scottish. Not for the traditional reasons people might think, but for the less well-known heroes who inspire me every day. I hope you've enjoyed the show, and if you haven't understood me in England, don't worry, it'll be available with subtitles on the iPlayer. Come on, Polly, we've got work to do. Susan Kalman Is Convicted was written by me, Susan Kalman, with additional material by Jack Bernhardt and Tom Meenan. The producer was Lindsay Fenner.